Hi, I'm Malcolm Nichols.
And I'm Richard Ayling.
And this is Man Reimagined, a podcast where we, as men, attempt to reimagine ourselves in the 21st century.
How can we respond to the big questions that we're facing, both within ourselves and within society, and make sense of this ever-changing world?
We don't have all the answers, but we do want to create a conversation. So join us moving forward as a man reimagined.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to yet another episode of the Man Reimagined podcast with myself, Richard Ayling, and my good friend over in New Zealand, Malcolm Nichols. Today, we're going to bring in a special guest who is kind of a coach and mentor of mine and someone that I've spent a lot of time with in the last year, and that is John Nyland. He is the founder of the Self-Worth Academy, which I've been studying to be an associate of now, and the topic we're going to talk about is self-worth. It's such a huge topic for human beings. We're going to dive into what it actually means, but also why it's important for men to start to look at this topic a little bit more deeply, because it's so important for us right now. And Malcolm and I have found it to be a crux of our work for the last year. That said, Malcolm hasn't actually met John. And so he's going to be learning at the same time as you guys as to what self-worth is, what self-esteem is, what the difference is, and how this actually applies to our daily lives in terms of work, in terms of the relationships that we have to other people, but fundamentally the relationship that we have to ourselves. So without further ado, Malcolm, just come on and say hi briefly. We know who you are.
Hello.
He does take things literally. That's fair. So Mal's here. Let's get to the real star guest of the show, and that is John. John, welcome. Thank you so much for taking your time today.
Hello from me. Good to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Welcome. So, I mean, it just occurred to me, you know, a couple of weeks back, like I want to talk about self-worth on this podcast, but you and I we met for the first time in real life, you know, this whole, this COVID, post-COVID concept. And we had this beautiful walk for several hours in Cascais in here in Portugal. And we talked about all of this that we're hopefully going to be able to share today. And I was like, why on earth would I try and talk about this? Why wouldn't I get John on? And of course, you were more than happy to come along. So let's start with you just telling us a bit about yourself, your background and why the self-worth journey where it started for you, because that's not what you've been doing for a lot of your life, is it?
No, not at all. I'm a late bloomer as far as self-worth is concerned. I guess I'm a fairly typical product of the self-esteem culture. Yeah, in fact, for me, self-esteem was a step up on what I'd gone on before. I got a very traditional Irish Catholic upbringing where you were good by following rules and following processes and so on. And I had the usual problems with that, as you can well imagine. So when I learned about self-esteem, which, you know, the guy who's written several books on it, Nathaniel Brandon, defines as your reputation with yourself. When I got to that point where I could, you know, operate to my own reputation with myself, if you like, that for me was a step up on what I'd done. It's like, wow, this is great. But as I learned to do that during my 20s and early 30s, again, rather slowly, I also became a prisoner of that culture. I didn't know I was, but throughout several decades of my life, I was ruled by a tyrant in my head. And the tyrant in my head had never-ending expectations as to what I should be and what I should be doing and how successful I should be and all manner of other words with should and need to and must in it. And it wasn't until 2016, I had a succession of losses during 2016, end of relationship, a business project that went badly, certain political developments that I'd rather not talk about, some of the consequences of those on my investments and on a charity I care very much about. A host of things happened during 2016 that really took me out of the knees. It robbed me of energy. And I, in my coaching and mentoring work, felt like a complete imposter because I was working with people on energy and motivation and all kinds of things. And I was not feeling it. And the events of that year triggered a whole series of questioning about whose expectations was I trying to meet in the first place. And that's when I discovered the tyrant in my head. And these days I talk about self-worth as opposed to self-esteem, because self-esteem is meeting these expectations, and self-worth is this unconditional sense of friendship with ourselves that, to be perfectly honest, I had no experience of until my mid-50s.
Wow. That you mentioned being a late bloomer right at the beginning, and it seems like several stages of awareness that, you know, we all experience, or hopefully we all experience at some point. What did that self-esteem lifestyle kind of actually look like? Because you talked about these expectations in your own mind, like how are you living, just to give people a deeper sense of, yeah, what that looks like for you.
Well, I was busy. The self-esteem lifestyle is a busy lifestyle. I was at work, always climbing the next hill. My holidays looked like work projects. You know, I had about 10 of them a year because I felt I should, you know, so I did. But that in itself turned into an expectation. I became financially independent at 52, which some would regard as an achievement. But for me, it was like, okay, what's next? You know, and there was always the what's next. I was ruled by a series of expectations about myself. In relationships, if anything happened in a relationship, and in 2016, I was mourning the loss of a relationship. When things went badly in relationships, that always said something about me. I was not living up to my own expectations of where I should be right now. Birthdays, you know, particularly big birthdays, where should I be right now? Always painfully conscious of what I was and what I was not.
Beautiful. And I can strongly relate to that. And I imagine there are quite a few people listening will as well. How did life change for you on a personal level? Because we're going to obviously zoom out and talk about self-esteem and self-worth and what that looks like in detail. But if you can zoom out and look in detail anyway, like what did self-worth actually, well, how did, like when you realized this, when you had that, these realizations in 2016, did you start to live differently immediately? Like what did this realization for how you've been living do for you?
It was not immediate. The winter of 2016 was, you know, my memory of it is a cold and gray winter. Wherever I looked, I was not finding meaning. I was not finding purpose. Even though I was reading books about it, you know, I was like a guy who was reading recipe books, but not able to taste the food. A sort of long COVID effect of reading recipe books, but not able to taste the food. And that's, you know, I knew about motivation. I knew about bereavement. I'd read all this stuff. I was coaching. I was speaking at conferences on this stuff, for God's sake. But I just wasn't feeling it. You know, I wasn't living it. The winter was cold and gray. It was like, who am I at this stage of my life? What am I? You know, trying to find went into different spiritual movements, trying to find something there. More expectations not met. Let me add. A lot of questioning. It was like a stripping away of the paintwork. It was as if it was like an old chair or table that somebody was stripping away at all the layers of paint. And it was only when that stripping away of expectation and of achievements happened that I began to glimpse the old wood underneath that I had not seen for a long time.
So that's an interesting distinction. Instead of kind of trying to be something more and add layers on, you know, of achievement of whatever, it sounds like you said you're stripping away something to find something at your core, right? If this old wood, this old Irish wood, like there's something at your core that you're trying to tune back into. What came to mind before you mentioned exploring spirituality was that, you didn't find God, as some people often do when they're on their knees. You found yourself by the sounds of things, and you know, we can use self in different ways. So what did that look like?
Well, there is a spiritual side to my life. There always has been. But what I distinguish sharply between is my own spiritual life and various movements. And it doesn't really matter what the movements are. I'm not going to get into the labels here, because what I came across in a lot of these movements was a lot of people advising me on what I should and shouldn't be doing. And, you know, I didn't want advice. Now, the last thing I needed in the winter of 2016 was advice or exhortation that I needed to, you know, practice more self-care or, you know, live a more balanced life or whatever. I just didn't need, I didn't need a lot of these cliched coaching questions that I got during that year. What I particularly valued, and particularly where I got it from men, by the way, what I particularly valued that year was really being listened to and really being heard. And I cannot tell you how few people did that. You know, a lot of coaches and spiritual teachers wanted to give me their brand of salvation. And I got very annoyed with some of them.
I'm muted, but I've been chuckling along to this for a while. I resonate strongly. Mao, I'd love to just bring you in and just sort of, you know, get a sense of where you're at on hearing this so far.
Hey, Richie. Yeah, I mean, it's it's really interesting. I mean, what in many ways what I'm hearing you describe, John, is a spiritual journey. What you've particularly in that 2016, it sounds like the way you talked about the stripping back the layers and getting to the old wood, into the core. I mean, that to me sounds like you made a journey. You made a spiritual journey or whatever journey that is. And so I guess in a way I'm curious to know, I'm kind of hanging on the next piece really of what after, you know, all the stripping away occurred in 2016, what came next?
Well, there wasn't a road to Damascus experience, but there was one very memorable Sunday morning when I was out running in the Forêt des Soins near Brussels, where I then lived. And again, my running was another project. So I always, I was running with all the devices and the timers, and I had to be running the Brussels 20K at least a few minutes faster than the year before. And, you know, it really was, when I look back on it with considerable laughter at, the way in which I measured my objectives everywhere in life, even when running. But I was out running and some of the stripping away had pretty much happened at that point. And I began to glimpse this sense of unconditional friendship with myself that I had read about and heard about, God knows, even written about, but wasn't tasting. And on that Sunday morning, out running in the forest, I ran for the joy of running. And I always think of that Sunday as one of the glimpses, if you like, of this unconditional friendship with self and how absolutely countercultural that is, you know, because we're not brought up that way. I wasn't. We still aren't. In fact, it's got worse. I work with young people today who have even more expectations of themselves than we would have been brought up with many years ago. But for me, that was new. I had never, you know, and I remember the feeling on that Sunday morning of, wow, you know, what if I can be unconditionally on my own side today, no matter how far I run, no matter what I achieve, what I don't achieve, if I could just be a loyal friend to myself, whether anyone else is or not, is, you know, secondary. And that for me was a breakthrough. It was like I broke through to a sunlit valley that I never knew was there.
Yeah, John, I mean, again, it just strikes me the way you're describing of this. It's the sense of awakening that is there. You know, and one of the things I'm really enjoying about the way you're describing this is you're using quite gentle language, and it might be the Irish accent that's giving it even a further push. I don't know, but often in Buddhist circles, they talk about or other circles, unconditional love, you know, or yoga and whatever else. But this the idea of unconditional friendship, it evokes in me the sense of kind of you've got an arm around yourself, you know, and kind of just kind of supporting and holding, you know. That's one of the things that's really striking me at the moment is just that the gentleness of the language you're using of describing this journey, which, if you know, to me it's you're describing an age-old journey, really, you know, that's, you know, for century,
totally.
Thousands of years, the human journey, really, right?
It is, and again, this is where language becomes, for me at least, can become a problem. I like to strip back. You notice I avoid the word love. I prefer the word friendship. Isn't it extraordinary? With, you know, the word love is used everywhere. Walk into a bookshop anytime and find me a book on friendship. You know, there's a challenge. Like, there are certain topics that are thoroughly explored and we all think we know what the words mean. But I have fairly carefully avoided that word self-love in writing the Self-Worth Safari. And that's not accidental. I prefer to find some new words that are less laden with, you know, the heritage of other isms. And that's why I like the word friendship, because for me, being a friend to myself was a genuine new discovery. No one had ever suggested to me, at least not that I remember, no one had ever suggested to me growing up as a young man that I could be an unconditional friend to myself. On the contrary, what I'd heard was the shoulds. You know, you should go for this job. You should buy a house. You should think about getting married. You should change countries. You should go for promotion. You should, you know, be an entrepreneur, whatever.
Yeah, a lot of these shoulds, I mean, they come from within, but they're therefore also from sort of society's expectations and externally from people. So like for as long as I can remember working in this area of transformation and just personal growth, the word should is something that it became a swear word. It's like the word expectation. It's just not helpful. And yet when I sort of talk about this, not everyone's on board with that. There's, it's kind of a new thing. And you've almost managed to sort of codify that in one of these shifts that you talk about in the Self-Aware Safari, which is a book that a friend recommended me about a year ago or so now, maybe April last year. And when I read that book, it was like the missing piece in my learning, right? Like I've done so much growth and transformation and healing and yada, 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 without going off into my long journey, because everyone's got one. But that was the piece that I especially needed to hear at that time. You know, like I've got the things. There was a moment years back when I had the money, I had the house, I had the 4-hour work week, and I was still left feeling empty. And there were still expectations that I was placing on myself that I should be feeling differently and I should be doing more, and still that word again. And it was, where's this coming from? And it was only until last year when I read your book that it suddenly dawned on me. It's like, oh, there's an alternative that's possible. And that really landed. And as soon as I read your book, I was like, just like when I did the Wim Hof method years ago, it's like, this is profound. Everyone needs to understand and experience this. And I became an instructor back then. And it was the same. And I reached out to you and we had a great conversation. And here we are a year later. And so I always bring it into my coaching work. Like whenever I'm working with someone, it's not sort of the packaging, because people don't quite understand what it is yet. And so I'd love you to dive into that. But it's when, as soon as I bring it in and I speak to the shifts that you talk about, they get it. People get it. And they're like, wow. So I'd like you to speak damn something more eloquently than I could about, you know, the contrast between self-esteem, self-worth, how this affects people's lives, and perhaps something towards the shifts or a sense of them as well.
Well, as you're speaking, Richard, I'm thinking of applying this to men, because obviously that's, you know, part of why we're here. We have a shared interest in self-worth amongst men. And if we look at what happens for a lot of men at the moment, and not just young men, I might add, but men of pretty much all ages, is we have internalized this habit of self-assessment. So we're constantly checking in and measuring ourselves. And I don't just mean the obvious parts, but we are checking in and measuring ourselves as to how we're doing. And, you know, whether that's in running, whether that's at work, whether that's how we're doing with the ladies or whoever it is we're interested in, or whether it's, how we measure up in terms of physique, in terms of friends, in terms of social media, and I might add in terms of personal development and leadership and all these other areas which have added to the burden of expectation, particularly for men. And by the way, have I not mentioned, we're supposed to be super confident as well. You know, oh, and great communicators, and have empathy, and what have I missed? So, you know, it doesn't take long to create a shopping list of 20 things. You can be absolutely sure we're not going to score highly in all 20 of them. So guess what? We start measuring our performance. And this habit of self-assessment is woven into us at a very early age, probably by teachers and parents who try to install the software drivers in our heads to supervise us when they're not around. You know, so if we're constantly measuring ourselves by our own expectations, that probably will act as a kind of, secret supervisor when they're not present to actually keep an eye on us. It does become a tyrant. And the problem for many men, as I see it, is, and I do a lot of coaching with men, particularly men who are going through major life changes. And boy, oh boy, who are you now when you don't have that role, or when you don't have that position, or you don't have that job title, or when you can no longer afford private education for the kids? Now, who are you? You know, hard questions of identity that start to, in many cases, become life-threatening for some men. And when I say life-threatening, I'm not being over-dramatic here, but, you know, the suicide rates amongst men are very well documented. I don't have to go into them in any more detail. And it's not just the obvious. There is also the alcohol, the pills, the substance abuse, the medication, the crazy driving. You know, how many ways do we have of articulating frustration as men when we don't feel we're measuring up, or when we don't feel we're good enough? So that's the first habit that I usually call attention to, which is the habit of self-assessment. A lot of traditional approaches start with acceptance, but to be honest, We don't know what we're accepting if we don't first understand the extent to which we're ruled by these self-assessments. And they're everywhere.
Mm. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, John. You're right, and I really like that distinction between self-assessment versus self-acceptance as a starting point. I'm curious. Once you do the self-assessment, I mean, is it then a matter of self-acceptance, or is it what once you've done this kind of assessment, how do you then what do you then do, particularly as you're working with men? You know, how are you taking that and using that information?
Well, when we did the pilots back in 2017, 2018, before the book was published, we actually started with self-acceptance, because that is, in many traditions, is the beginning of change, or the beginning of learning. But we found that in practice, there was at least two shifts that needed to happen before self-acceptance had any real meaning. The first I've already mentioned, which is switching from all these self-assessments to simple self-assertion. So that might be as simple as, you know, when you spot a self-assessment, just take a sip of water, you know, come back to reality, start understanding that these self-assessments are just assessments. They're not realities. And the second, and again, for men, this one is often very easy to grasp. The second shift, as described in the book, is instead of doing things as a condition of self-esteem, do it as an expression of self-worth. So if I'm going to go to the gym, for example, am I going to the gym as an expression of who I am for fun, for enjoyment? Or am I going to the gym to prove something to myself? If I'm going into a meeting, am I going into the meeting to just express myself in that meeting, or am I trying to prove myself in that meeting? It's that switch from doing things, as it's described in the book, switching from condition to expression. Now we're ready for some self-acceptance. Now we begin to understand what we're up against, what we're trying to accept.
Yeah. So it almost sounds like, so I mean, obviously I don't, there might be more, but it's more like self-acceptance is part of the end game, and this is the journey to that end game. I mean,
I put in there, okay, not quite. Now self-acceptance is the beginning of another part of the journey, which is about usefulness, which is about being interested in the world around us, and actually moving past self-preoccupation. So sorry for the interruption, but I don't see that self-acceptance is the end game, actually. On the contrary, it's an important way marker on the road to another stage, which is about being of use in the world, being of service. Again, we need to be careful of language here, because that word gets hijacked into servitude sometimes. We don't want to go there, but useful, I prefer. How can we be useful? How can we contribute? The big thing that I'm against here is self-preoccupation. And I see that a lot of what's happening at the moment is deepening self-preoccupation. We're on a narcissistic journey through a lot of personal development, through a lot of spiritual movements, which is, we are literally worshiping ourselves as gods and goddesses in the mirror. Mm. This is not a happy road. There are more exciting adventures than how am I doing, and please worship me.
Oh, so true. I mean, I certainly can speak for myself, and being in this world of coaching and healing and the various things that I've done, and And often one of the things that gets bandied around in a lot of in the world of coaching, for example, is this thing of I want to help people. I want to help people. I hear that a lot. And often, and my first reaction always is, and who are you helping them for? For yourself or for them, you know? because it is so true, I think. And I have to ask myself that question a lot of times as well. It's like, what, you know, who am I doing this for right now? Is this, so what I'm, and as I'm hearing you speak, what you're talking very much to that thing. It's like, it's having the, part of what I'm hearing you do is checking what's driving this behavior in me. Is it the, I'm doing this because my head's telling me I should do this, that I should do this to make myself a better man. I should do this because I need to achieve something. And you're talking about becoming aware of all of these shoulds and the drivers and the need for internal sense of self-esteem, self-satisfaction or self-congratulation and flipping it and beginning to do it because it you know, you use the word, I think, because you feel called to, or at least that's a word that I would like to use as well. You know, I feel called to do this right now. So yeah, so it's, yeah, I'm really liking what you're talking about here, John.
The most thrilling place in that I know of in the marketplace right now is watching people and supporting people to develop a strong sense of professional identity, but not based upon self-esteem, but based on self-worth, so that they're doing what they want to do, whether they're leaders in the corporate world or whether they're somebody building their own business or whether there's somebody who's just walked away from the business world and, you know, decided they want to have an adventure in Southeast Asia. Fine, you know, but doing it because they really want to do it rather than because they're trying to prove something. And obviously a lot of, for me, the adventure bit is where we start to use this. You know, it's the things we do as a result of self-worth. This is where the excitement is. When you leave behind all the self-preoccupation and the needy helper stuff you just talked about, Malcolm, who are a nightmare. Needy helpers are a nightmare in any team. If you've ever managed them, if you've ever had to deal with them, they suck all the energy out of a room because they're craving the adjectives, you know, from everything they've ever done. Like, honestly, I would say to any leader, get rid of your needy helpers. They're not helping. They're you're really better off. You're better off having somebody who's, you know, if they're on a basis of self-worth and they're actually really living what they're called to do, whether in technology, whether in communications, whether in finance, these are the people we want to surround ourselves with. These are the people who are capable of working to common purpose, as opposed to the desperately narcissistic who are incapable of even comprehending common purpose because their only purpose is to get adjectives about themselves. And it's thrilling to work with people who are, you know, who break through that fog and actually get into the space where they're doing real things in the world and they're contributing in whatever way they choose to contribute on a firm footing of self-worth rather than on a needy basis of self-esteem.
So all of this sounds rather simple, John. I'm walking out of here thinking, all right, sweet, I'm just going to switch from self-esteem to self-worth and fuck them on. However, I'm sure it's probably not quite as simple as waving a wand like that. So, I mean, what, in terms of, you know, making the switch, how is it? Is it like, does it, what kind of work does it require from us? What do you get your people to do when you take them on this journey to self-worth? What are some of the things that they might play with and experience?
So a very simple, for some people, it is as simple as flicking a switch. I mean, the very act of educating themselves on the difference for some people is so transformative that they actually need very little handholding after that point. For many of us, me included, the change is not was not quite so transformational. It was a little bit more of a roller coaster. Of some days it's like, whoa, I get it, and then something happens. You know, you get rejected in love, or somebody doesn't want a meeting with you or something, and you go, what does that say about me? And suddenly we slip back into the self-reproach and the older habits, if you like. And here, reward of clarification. This is not positive psychology by another name. This is not about replacing negative thoughts with positive thoughts all the time. On the contrary, true self-worth entails the ability to deal with the so-called negative, to deal with grief, to deal with loss, to deal with anger, without artificially trying to transpose it into its positive equivalent. If we're not able to do that, then we're just feeding ourselves another addiction of positive thinking to replace and another expectation, I might add, that will be very hard to live up to. But very often it is it's the moments of rejection, it's the moments of setback, it's the moments of disappointment that actually teach us, okay, where am I with this? Am I able to sit with that disappointment for a short period of time and then move on? The moment for me that was very defining was, after I became single again and did a bit of dating, how did I deal with rejection in that world? If I could acknowledge it, but move past it in a matter of hours, then that was pretty good. On days when I wasn't doing that, then, okay, now what am I whipping myself with here? Isn't it an expectation about myself rather than anything else? And of course it was. And then it's very quickly we begin to discover that the old self-esteem drivers are still operating, John. The moments of setback, the moments of disappointment can be very illuminating in terms of which are we operating on, self-worth or self-esteem.
Beautiful, John. I'm thinking about men a little bit, and because the three of us here are men and we're talking about this, and Mal's brand new to your explanation of this contrast, and he's really getting it and vibing on it. And yet the vast majority of people that come to the self-worth work are women, right? That come to these 6-week courses that you offer, that buy the book, that showed up to Self-Worth Week. You know, these are all incredible events and things that are happening. And yet vast majority were women. So do you have a sense on why that is? Or do you have any, having asked some men perhaps, like, what's your take on that? And what can we do to get this message out there a bit more based on the benefits that you've already shared are there for men?
I don't think we're just seeing one factor. I mean, if I'm old enough to have been into coaching in the early years, and it was much the same. It was 3/4 female, 1/4 male, at least in Europe when it started around the millennium. And over time, those numbers balanced up a bit. So women are early adopters. You know, we have to grant them credit for that. This is whether it's a cultural movement, whether it's learning development, etc. Women tend to get in there earlier than we do. So it's not surprising that we're seeing a lot more women embarking on that journey. But it will change. I'm confident that it will change. And one of the reasons it's going to change is called adversity. So the very same forces that educated me back in 2016, without the aid of a book, in this case, from the legs up rather than from the head down, those very same forces are happening right now, right across the globe. Men threatened, their jobs threatened by their status, threatened by pandemic, post-pandemic effects. Loneliness now being talked about amongst men to a degree that was unthinkable even 5 years ago. Some fabulous new initiatives, by the way. I came across one yesterday in a small town in England, where dads get together on a Saturday morning. and they have done a fantastic little network, and one, you know, they have built a, not only something that's valuable personally, but also professionally, by dads getting together with their kids on a Saturday morning. Beautiful initiative. In Ireland, we have the Men's Sheds movement, where men get together in sheds to repair old tractors or bicycles or whatever. And by the way, have a, what I call a reality conversation. And one of the themes I know you're really hot on, Richard, is having real conversations. I think a lot of men are really desperate for real conversations. You know, not BS, you know, not platitudes, not, you know, a secret vocabulary coming from some culture of whatever, but actually being able to talk about things that are real. And there, I think, I am optimistic that we will see a leveling up in the years ahead. But we have catching up to do. There's no doubt when it comes to self-awareness generally, and when it comes to particularly fluency on language like acceptance and self-worth and self-esteem, women are 20 years ahead of us. They've been doing more work. And it's showing in the employment space as well. Just watch the people who are getting the jobs in communication, watch the people who are getting the jobs in leadership right now. You know, we now understand the need for empathetic leadership like never before. Look at Gareth Southgate's fantastic leadership of the English football team, primarily based on empathy. His empathy with players is legendary. Right across the economy, in sports, in work, even in banking, insurance, you know, people are now talking about empathetic leadership like we had never seen even a decade ago. So, and guess who's getting those jobs? So, guys, we have some catching up to do.
There's the... Just I'm looking at Malcolm, you know, on the video, and especially with that sort of 20 year gap that you were talking about. I think there's an acknowledgement from both of us, but there's a sense, this word grim reality just sort of kind of came to mind. I mean, we're all here, sat here motivated to change that. And yes, it's also good to just point that reality out. I mean, I know you're not stating fact, you're stating how you see things. But this is also how I feel as well. And yet, ironically, doesn't it sort of potentially put pressure on men to step up? I just came off a live Instagram conversation with a really cool gentleman, and he was talking about how men actually feel pressure to step up, you know, from partners in all areas of life at the moment, and it often makes us shut down. And so we need that psychological safety to just relax and open up and just find ourselves again, and perhaps that old wood that you were talking about. And that's, you know, that's the value of a circle for me. And yet we're in a weird place where we have to kind of own this need to catch up in some way. So how does self-worth play a role in that?
To claim our space. You know, one of the things I've been dying to say for a while, and this is a great place to say it, is guys, everyone who's listening to this, can we stop responding to what other people expect of us? Like, that's back in the same old problem again. You know, if you're just trying to become a better communicator to make the women in your life happy, you're missing the point, right? The point here is that we step up and claim our own space, that we define who we want to be, which, you know, to be fair, men have always done. It is time for us to step up and claim our own space. That is what self-worth is about. It's about unconditional friendship with yourself, not the thirst to meet other people's expectations. So, you know, let's solve the pressure a little bit. I appreciate some of it might be healthy, but there is also a healthy moment when we go, let's just park other people's agendas here and ask ourselves, who do we want to be? You know, who do I want to be in this world? What values do I stand for? Whether it pleases other people or not, or whether it's cool or not, whether it's attractive or Instagrammable or not, to hell with all of that. What actually matters is who do we want to be? And this is a good time for men to be asking that question.
It's so good to hear you say that, John, because I couldn't agree any more about what you've just said. And you know, this interesting piece. So I love the distinction between the stepping up and feeling the pressure as an external thing to step up, or wanting to step up because that just feels like the right fucking thing to do. And I certainly, speaking for myself and speaking for Rich, that feels like, in a way, it's why we're doing this. This is our piece for us of our stepping up. It's a calling to support men, but it's our journey of stepping up, right? This is the way that we're doing it and how we're starting to do it. So, I love that, and actually, hearing those that framed up and described in that way, it's like there in and of itself is just such a beautiful message to encapsulate, and to start to share and to spread. Yeah, thank you for putting those words together in that way, John.
And I applaud the courage of what you guys are doing here. You're, for all the reasons I've already mentioned, you're early in this space. It's not mainstream yet for men.
Well, the first time that's been said about me, John. I'm normally I'm a Luddite when it comes to technology and that kind of stuff a degree. So it's nice to be an early adopter about something. And Richard knows all about that. He'll be nodding his head, going, "Yeah."
Whatever about the technology, you're early in, the getting men to think in this way and working with men, to think in this way. It's still early days. Of course, there are other movements going on, as I've already mentioned, but it's still early days to be raising awareness here. And of course, there's a lot of guys that are going to go, "Oh, that's just more namby-pamby stuff. No interest, what's on telly?" Fine. You're going to get that too. But I really applaud the courage that you guys have with this initiative. It's really badly needed. I mean, for many of our younger men, it literally is a life or death issue. I really salute the initiative and the courage that you have to put it together.
Thank you, John. And it's just been so nice to hear you phrase all of this in your own words. And as Malcolm said, and he did speak for me then as well, this is so important to us, and it has been our own journey, and it's not been an easy one, right? It's sort of the step up, almost not as a role model, I don't like that word, but to say, hey, look, this is possible here. I mean, we had long conversations before we chose to actually make this podcast, not knowing what it would become, and that wasn't the fucking point. It's like, would you be doing this if two people were listening? Well, probably not every week, because it gets a bit boring mail after a while. No, but actually, that's nonsense, because this is what we were talking about. And the more guests we bring in and to hear it from these different angles, it's so helpful. And you've really rooted in for me, even at a deeper level, someone that's been working with you for a year every week now, John, what self-worth means and how important it is for men, and how we need to, as you said, claim our space. And that's not in some retroactive way to balance the books or anything. It's just for ourselves as humans. Women have been doing it for a while, and it's been beautiful to watch. Like, let's find our version of doing that, right?
Yeah. And let's find our version. Let's not just clone what's happening in women's circles, etc. That won't work. I know you both know this already, but again, I'm saying this for me. Just cloning what's happening in the women's development world isn't going to work for us guys. We need to be a bit more creative. We need to find our own way to do this. Which is why I love seeing the Dad's Initiative, the Men's Sheds in Ireland, and the other initiatives that are going on here and there at grassroots level around Europe and probably further afield. I'm just not familiar. I do think we're right at the beginning of this, and there's an exciting adventure ahead.
Yeah. But mine, to kind of wrap things up, because I think this has been such a healthy and an interesting conversation. And I want to offer you the chance, John, to kind of, is there anything you want to share in terms of an aspect of your message that you haven't yet, or anything that's going on, you know, professionally for the Self-Worth Academy? Because I'm going to put the link to the Self-Worth Safari book in the show notes. That's something that I think every human should read, regardless of how they identify, for obvious reasons that we've well covered in this talk. But is what else is going on that you would love to, yeah, is there a message or something else you want to share with us?
Oh, I'll probably pick the wrong one. I guess a lot of my current interest is working with men and women, for that matter, to rebuild their professional identity based upon a rather changed landscape, whether they chose it or not. And some are choosing it. It isn't just happening to people. Some are consciously choosing. They want a different professional identity. As I said earlier, it's for me, what's exciting is seeing self-worth in action. And right now, a lot of the action is in the workplace. It's in the professional space. It's not the only place, but it's one that I'm very much involved in. So working with people to rebuild or re-articulate maybe their professional identity. So they're not just, it's not just about what you are, but who you are in the marketplace. And that's not just a semantic difference. So that's going on. For anybody interested in self-worth, well, the book, The Self-Worth Safari, is there. And we always have programs, training facilitators and associates in this field of self-worth. Someday we hope that this will become a significant area of study in its own right. But we are in a very, there's been a lot of study on self-esteem, practically nothing in terms of self-worth. We're at a very, very early stage of this being out there, so to speak.
And yet, I'm not sure, I'm not going to mention any names of organizations just in case I'm not allowed to, but I know that Self-Worth Academy has been in teaching at some very well established organizations and received some great feedback as well, right? So yeah, share as much as you're allowed or can, but that's you know, it's this isn't some esoteric weird concept out there. It's making a real impact.
Well, we have been doing career development work with small and large companies, the largest being Microsoft, which you'll definitely have heard of, but also in universities. I'm particularly excited by the potential of students learning more about self-worth, A, for their own resilience as they go through the student life experience, particularly now. But secondly, as part of their career development, so developing a pre-professional identity even before they step into a job, can be something of tremendous value to young people.
Beautiful. All right, then let's wrap things up. I'm just going to say a huge thank you. Mal, I'm sure you're going to want to do your own version of these and you can close it up. But John, I've been learning from you for the last year or so now, and I'm really grateful to have you here today. I'll keep the platitudes short and sweet. You know that, you know, there's enough of it out there, and then it becomes a 5-minute outro. It's like, fuck you now. just thank you. You know, just thank you so much for what you're doing, for this book, and for the impact that it's having on me, men, and so many other people. And I will I'll see you tomorrow on the call, I expect.
And John, yeah, I'd like to say thank you very much as well. It's been a real pleasure to hear you speak and to share all the great information you've got. And you know, and just anybody who's listening, if there's anything that you want, any thoughts, observations that you want to share about what you've heard from John, you know, share it on the podcast that you've listened to, share it on the Facebook page, get in touch with us, give John a call if you're really interested and want to get involved with all the work he's doing, or Rich as well, because I know that Rich is heavily involved in it too. So John, thank you so much, and maybe we'll have you back again one time if you'll grace us with your presence.
Thanks guys, been a pleasure, really enjoyed it.
From this week's podcast, if there's been anything that's inspired you, challenged you, or simply left you wanting more, then please reach out to Richie and Mal via their Facebook page, Man Reimagined. Just like you, we're trying to get a handle on all these issues and topics, so the more we're able to share and talk about them, I think the better off we're all going to be. Until next time, catch you later.